you know, potential serious injury. I guess the other option, though, would just to say lost surgical specimens in general. I think, Stan, you might have mentioned that piece, or maybe that was another one you were talking about. Anyway.
No, that's exactly right, just loss in general.
Loss in general to sort of get away from the point that you may not know what the potential patient impact is for years.
Well, are we confusing the handling of the specimen and the handling of the report?
We're just talking about the specimen.
Right.
The report comes lower down.
Clear, yeah.
So if you lose that, you know, in a prostate's not a good example because you can always, you know, re-biopsy the prostate, but say it was a mole or something that you lose, and then there's no way to re-biopsy potentially. So then it's irretrievable, and you don't have you don't know what the impact's going to be for a long time potentially.
And it was that lost mole in the nursing home that we worried about too, because there are a lot of procedures going on there, and this is exactly the kind of thing that could happen in that environment as well.
Yeah, I've lost these in offices too. And you know, not only surgical, but you can see that the urine for porphyrins, the colposcopy specimen, a blood test for paternity, you know, where somebody then dies and the body's cremated. I mean, there are all kinds of things that happen with lost laboratory and pathology specimens where the injury isn't really so much the issue, but the trajectory of the care plan is modified irretrievably. I once lost a lumpectomy specimen from a breast in the office. And, you know, who knows whether that was important or not. I don't know if she was injured, but we absolutely had to change the future of her life. This is going to be a tough one when we talk about the outcome measure. But, and on the other hand, this is another example where the first I've seen where simply losing the specimen can't be the process measure, because we toss your analyses all the time. We say, oh, shoot, I lost your, you know, urine glucose, whatever. So we're going to have to come up with some kind of a severity measure here, and I'm a little bit at a loss right now for how we phrase it.
Well, I thought the potentially the wording of irretrievable was important, because then you can say, you know, it's not the urine that you can just ask them for another urine. So something that really can't be repeated or replaced, and we could, you know, maybe add that to the definitions. And then, you know, and then maybe you don't need the death or serious injury, because if it's basically any specimen, sample, whatever the word is, that can't be captured again, maybe that's bad enough that should be reported.
Well, this is Sally. From a consumer viewpoint, I mean, irretrievable. You can do another biopsy, right? But
not always.
You certainly wouldn't want to from, you know, from the patient perspective.
Oh, no, no. An excisional biopsy, it's all gone.
Yeah, yeah, you can't always even re-biopsy.
So that would consider, that would be considered irretrievable.
Correct.
Right.
Oh, for all biopsies or just some?
No, just for
some.
Mm-hmm.
Just the irretrievable ones. And okay. That may be the pivotal word here. We might have to settle for less than perfect, but I sort of like irretrievable because it combines both the outcome and the process.
So back to the issue of death or serious injury, should it just be any irretrievable loss procedural specimens?
Well, what if there is another site you could biopsy?
Yeah.
And it's not irretrievable.
This is Diane. I think there are kind of issues related to both this event and the next one on the list. The next one on the list is framed a little bit differently, but it includes unnecessary invasive procedure as one of the measures you would look at as well. So death, serious disability, or the need for another invasive procedure, i.e. a second biopsy on a different site. Would it be helpful if we thought of it that way, as, you know, being able to capture not just those that are irretrievable and can't be redone because the whole lesion is gone, but those where you could possibly do a second biopsy, but it requires a second invasive procedure?
Irretrievable does not mean what we're describing. I think we need clarity over that, and I think what you just said makes sense. The irretrievable, you know, doesn't mean that there is no other site you could biopsy. It means that specimen is lost.
Right. But is it the irretrievable that's important, or
yeah,
is it the outcome to the patient that they required a second procedure to redo the test, or there was a serious disability or death that resulted from the loss of the specimen?
Well, I've had lots of people that had come in for a second blood draw. So, Diane, you're going to have to. First of all, I don't even like number 8 because I think it's too fuzzy, but
I agree, it's fuzzy.
We need some sort of a severity measure that will discriminate between, you know, these minor things where something gets tossed, and you know, for example, somebody's blood alcohol. Well, you come back 2 hours later, you can never get the blood alcohol again, but so what, you know?
Yeah, but I think that gets to the definition of what an invasive procedure is. I agree that 8 is fuzzy, but again, when I think of how we define an invasive procedure in Minnesota, a routine blood draw for a blood alcohol wouldn't be considered an invasive procedure. There are certain things that we exempt. So,
well,
a lot
what about
of blood
a spinal
sample.
Tap?
Pardon?
You know, I mean, I think it's a slippery slope because what about a spinal tap? You know, what about a, you know, is biopsying the other part of your basal cell carcinoma invasive, or, you know?
Well, to us it would be. I mean, we have a standard list that we use, and I guess I agree that 8's fuzzy. I think 7's a little fuzzy, but what I'm proposing is that the severity measure that we look at is death, serious disability, or the need for a second invasive procedure. I know that that does raise the issue of defining what an invasive procedure is, which is a whole other can of worms. I feel like we have an approach that works for us. It may not work for everyone. But to us, that would allow us to differentiate between, you know, that routine blood draw and the spinal tap or the biopsy.
And hence the word irretrievable then needs to be modified.
Yeah.
Well, what about the breast biopsy, the breast lump I lost, where we just couldn't now go biopsy stuff forever, but this woman needed a change in her surveillance forever, you know, lifelong about cancer risk.
And would you consider that to be serious disability?
No, unless you really want to broaden disability to include change of risk, which
right.
Some organizations have done, actually. I want to defer that discussion to when we actually discuss it, because this may be the poster child example of why we want... I've seen the definition expanded to say the imposition of an unknown future risk, of a changing risk category.
And
like the toxicological exposures and radiation exposures and stuff.
Yeah, and you're right that is a huge change in how we think of serious disability. So what you're saying is there are some cases where a specimen is lost and there is no serious disability based on our current understanding of that term, and there is no ability to do a second procedure in response to the lost specimen.
Yes.
Okay.
This is Sally again. To clarify, on the definition that we're looking at, it does say serious injury rather than serious disability. So I think this is, again, when we talk definitions, I guess next week or whenever, this is something we're really getting into a lot between disability and injury that I think we need to clarify, because, again, from my viewpoint as a consumer, it wouldn't rise to the level of disability, but changing the outcome, the treatment plan, could be injury if it's not warranted and you don't know that. It's just a risk you have to take if you've lost the sample. So
and some people have used the word harm, and
mm-hmm.
I find myself disposed to it.
No, the terminology of preventable harm is quite common in a lot of the government circles.
This is Greg. I think there are a couple of issues. I think one is whether or not we think that that the death of serious injury related to irretrievable lost surgical specimens can be combined with the one below it, the diagnostic testing error. And then it's whether or not the irretrievable specimens in and of themselves deserve to be reported, just because there is no way to go back and assess the impact in some of these cases, was I think illustrated by the examples there. I'm really having a hard time thinking about the feasibility of defining these if we don't have something very concrete like irretrievable, and I would love to see more detail on how Minnesota or others do that, but I think that's going to be a hang-up here.
This is Michael with a suggestion that might not be good. Could we assign some people to try to wordsmith these? I think we've laid out a number of concrete problems, but I'm fond of these in spirit. And I'd hate to toss them just because we can't on the fly come up with some good language. I'd really relish seeing this deferred to next time, but with the understanding that some really smart people could come up with a better one to consider.
This is Peter Angus. If you guys want to proceed in that direction, that's fine. It might delay our processing a little bit, but you know, if there's agreement and commitment to it, the commitment being important. Again, these are NQF's product. These are ideas that have come in from external sources. But if you want to refine them, just because you don't want to lose the concept, that's fine.
This is Cynthia Hain. I would suggest we include the next one in that group that Michael's talking about as well. These three things, in my mind, were the biggest cause of lawsuits that I've seen, and I think they're all very preventable through good process measures. So I agree that they're important, and they should be addressed. And I think that all three of them involve three different processes, and I think they're all similar in some other respects.
And Michael agrees, and I'd be willing to work on this.
And along those lines, it may be that there may be an umbrella way to put these three together as something as an SRE related to failures in serious failures in diagnostic testing, including the loss of a irretrievable specimen, including death or serious disability or related to a having to do a repeat procedure. I think all three of those could potentially be combined under the rubric of serious diagnostic testing error.
We call these lost opportunity.
So do I have some volunteers to try to wordsmith this? And maybe, Peter, if you can help lead that, shepherd that process along, but to try to pull together and just to make sure that we're all on the same page here, is to pull together the SRE related to the irretrievable lost surgical specimens, that related to the diagnostic testing error resulting in unnecessary invasive procedures, and then the failure to communicate follow-up on test results. The latter is going to be particularly problematic in terms of the long lag times there are in some of those cases. But if who's willing to help Peter try to pull those together?
Cynthia Hain, I would volunteer. I've been involved in a lot of these types of issues.
Michael Viktorov, I do these all day.
Great.
Okay, Mike and Cynthia. Yep, Mike and Cynthia, we'll follow up with you. Thank you.
That'd be great.
Great, thanks.
If we can, then, we'll move on to number 10, which is the death or serious injury resulting from care provided by an impaired healthcare worker. And Tejal and Eric, any additional comments from your TAPS?
It was, for our setting, it was just that it was definitely relevant. We agreed with sort of combining this with the next one. You know, I think the feasibility, you know, piece definitely raised our eyebrows as well, though, in terms of how one would actually implement this.
Do we have a uniform definition of what impaired means?
We had a suggestion from our group, which is in the spreadsheet here, which included a whole bunch of things, which actually the group felt strongly to include drug, alcohol, depression, medical illness, and sleep deprivation as part of impaired. But again, the feasibility of
going to make it ambiguous.
Yes,
yeah.
We thought it was going to be ambiguous. We thought it was a great measure, it's a great suggestion, but ambiguous.
I would support collecting some ambiguous stuff.
We'll pitch on these two. I think that the impaired health care worker is already required to be reported to their appropriate board, at least in most states, number one. Number two, to the extent it results in a criminal activity, you then have the police involved, have their own investigation, and I think that this, by making these SREs, would complicate the interaction there as well as with the state boards, and I personally would be opposed to having these added as SREs.
This is Greg. Just to kind of foreshadow what will become part of our discussion of existing SREs is when we get to those related to criminality, that there is that issue of duplicate reporting, and in addition to that, there's probably an additional nuance to this, which is introduced with just the passage of time, and that is with the Patient Safety Act, what are the implications of reporting these up, for example, to a PSO in terms of discoverability, and does this, is that some way cloud the issue here?
This is Sally. I think the criminal process is very separate from this, so we shouldn't concern ourselves overly with that. And reporting for the sake of transparency, hoping to move forward in terms of patient safety, is important that is separate from the criminal process, if there is one. And we all know from the policy viewpoint that some states do a much better job than others about any sort of, you know, impaired provider standards, that it's not happening in all states. So there probably is a need for a universal measure. But I'm kind of concerned that the TAP, I guess Stan's TAP had, I mean, I understand where it's coming from, but that this, if we list it as an event, that it would lead to false accusations. I mean, that's something that you have to be concerned with, but I'm not sure in this process that it's something that we should be thinking about.
Sort of speaking not from the TAP, I guess I would agree with that too. That was brought up by one of our members, but, you know, I guess as a regulator on the other side, I think that impairment is always an important issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not here to try a case, right?
Right.
So that's not the deal here. That's going to happen separately if it does, but that's not our job as far as reporting of events.
Right.
A point of clarification for me, I kind of thought that the NQF had the role of saying what kinds of events ought to be reported, but I don't notice that we say to whom they should be reported, and that's how we got things like stolen babies and stuff. You know, report to the newspaper, report to the journals, whatever. I think that it's good that we're silent on to where these are reported, and if that's true, then I would just let the chips fall with this one, because I think collecting numerators on this is important, and we should hope for improvement as we learn how to do it.
Peter, again, the framework report that we are just about ready to release after board approval in September on public reporting of patient safety events covers many of these issues. And so, again, stay focused on the list. The framework report deals with the other issues.
This is Greg. There are two issues I want to make sure that we get further discussion on. The first one is related to the suggestion that came out of Stan's TAP, which was that this be broadened to basically state patient harm as a result of any criminal behavior on behalf of the provider. So broader than just impairment. Is that how do people feel about that? Is that would that be problematic, or is that assuage some concerns that people have?
This is Cynthia Haynes. As soon as you start saying criminal behavior, you've come to a conclusion about what occurred. Now, obviously, there's certain instances where it's obvious, but there's others where it's just an allegation by a patient or a coworker. And until a final investigation has occurred by the police, if it's an alleged criminal event, you wouldn't get to the point of reportability for years.
And again, that would be a separate process.
Well, and I would just note, too, that's obviously an issue with the current criminal events. And we've had cases where, I mean, as you know, even if something did occur, it's not always prosecuted. And so there have been cases where there's been a suspected sexual assault in a hospital in our state, and the police, for whatever reason, chose not to prosecute the case. That doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't occur or that it did occur, but that's raised a lot of questions for us about what's reportable and what's not in the current criminal categories, and I think the same would be true here.
And have you come to a conclusion or a point of view on that? I mean, that's really the crux of this.
We have generally said that, well, no. I'm going to say no to that because it is something we still struggle with, and to an extent we rely on hospitals to do some good faith reporting of those events before a determination has been made about what's going to happen in the legal system. So I don't think we have a good answer for it.
That same vein, does Minnesota address the impaired staff issues? Do you have a separate category for that?
No, we don't. And I agree with some of the comments from the TAP groups that it would be really difficult to determine what's the standard for impairment for certain issues. You know, the issue of marijuana was brought up, sleep deprivation. I don't know if there's a standard point at which a provider would be considered to be impaired, and I think that would be a challenge.
Yeah, this is Chris Koschel, and I agree. I'm less familiar with Maryland law than I am with Michigan, or having dealt with this somewhat when I was in Michigan, and I would agree that this would be extremely difficult because the statutes do vary state to state, and at least within Michigan, they varied by caregiver category, unfortunately, but they did.
This is Sally. I hate to interrupt. I apologize. I'm hopping off the call now. Look forward to talking to you all next week. And Lindsay and Peter, if you all could email me a brief recap of the balance of the call, I would really appreciate it.
Greg,
by all means, Sally, and safe travels. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Greg, this is Tejal. I also have to drop off now. If you move on to the existing SREs, I think Lindsay's done a nice job of capturing what our TAP suggestions were, but I apologize that I won't be able to speak to them in person.
Fair enough. We will get to some of them, so that's great. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, bye-bye.
So, given those comments about some of the difficulties here, where does that leave us with these two, and I do think we really ought to consider them. So I think the questions we have are applicable to both 10 and 11.
Well, I think the ambiguity issue comes up with where we draw the line on what impairment is and what's included and not included.
This is Michael. What if we said a consequence of staff determined to be impaired?
So,
are you implying like you show up with clearly alcohol in your breath and you're staggering around and they do a breathalyzer on you and you've been caring for patients? That kind of highly specific situation, is that what you're driving at?
Well, I think, see, because I'm struggling with this too, and I think the definition of an impairment is really, really tough, and I don't think we are in the position of providing it, but if the institution or the office or the Board of Medical Examiners or police determine that a person, you know, after due investigation, whatever they do, if they determine the person was impaired and we can see there was harm done in the course of that, then I think that sounds like a numerator we'd want to count. But I think there should be a determination. We shouldn't simply say, y'all make up something about who you think might be senile or stupid or tired today.
Well, it's Peter again. I guess there's an issue of timeliness then, and trying to match the event yeah. with the actual confirmation of impairment.
Yeah, I think this will end up being hard to define. And so the question is if we toss it for that reason, or if we say, oh, well, let's try to collect some and see if we discover a way to refine this as we go.
Yeah, I'd have a strong objection to using this as a testing set.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree. Many states, too, if you're determined to be an impaired practitioner, there are state laws which allow you to go for treatment and have that not be discoverable or reportable. I think this is difficult because we're not just talking about the potential injury to patients. We're also talking about the potential injury to individual practitioners based upon, you know, what occurs as far as an investigation and a report. So I think this is, I think it's obviously important, but I think it's way larger than we can probably tackle as an SRE at this point.
Well, and to me, this is Diane. I'm just trying to scroll through some of our earlier recommendations about inclusion criteria. I mean, this does focus on an individual provider and their behavior, and it may be and certainly could be indicative of a larger system issue within the facility, but
sure.
And it is important to know when an impaired provider causes harm, but in that sense, is it that different from an incompetent provider, you know, causing harm, causing serious injury or death to a patient? In either way, it's focusing on the behavior and actions of one individual provider, and that to me feels kind of qualitatively different from some of these other events, which focus more on larger processes.
I agree with you, Diane.
I agree with Diane's point. I just feel like we're moving away from the focus on the harm and then therefore the system analysis that needs to go on to correct those. And this is more focused on individual providers. You know, I certainly agree it's an important issue, but this does seem to be migrating away from our main focus of the harm or the death.
Is there anybody that feels differently about these two?
No, but that was the point I was trying to make with the arterial puncture and the use. I felt that that was also an individual as opposed to a system. Just throw that back in there.
Well, it all kind of begins to speak to, do you blame the individual when the system has a problem? And I think we'll be swamped with comments if we go too far into the individual. Yeah.
I think there is a way to parse this one out relatively cleanly, and that is that you think about just culture, that caring for a patient while you are impaired is always reckless and is therefore always ought to be disciplined, and I think there is individual culpability here.
But we can't let sleep deprivation be in there or the whole
No, it wouldn't be.
Ambiguous.
I think it's going to end up being a mood issue if we don't consider this one further. So.
Right.
Any other comments on the new SREs? I want to bring up one quick issue before we move off of new. But any other comments on those that we've discussed? Okay. One quick issue, and Peter, I may need your guidance on how we want to handle this. We did get, we were contacted about whether or not unsafe, and is Catherine McDonough on the call?
Yes, I am.
Great. So do you want to talk a little bit about the unsafe injection practices? And
okay, sure.
Again, we're kind of stuck by where we are in the process here and how we can fairly consider this, but I think the group should at least, you should have the chance to present to the group and let us have some quick input on it.
Okay, great. Well, I had had the opportunity in just working on patient safety projects to meet several of the folks who are working on a group called the Safe Injection Practices Policy Task Force. So I sent a note with documentation to Peter and Sally and Greg and Lindsay because I know it fell outside of our timeline. In other words, I didn't find out about all of this until, you know, our comment period was up. But I thought it was significant enough to bring up, because there is, particularly in ambulatory settings, a recent rash of hepatitis and other infectious diseases being happening because of unsafe injection practices. things like using single vial, single medication vials for multiple patients and lining up drugs, whether it's anesthesia or others, with using a single syringe and then changing the needle and pulling it out, but it actually is infecting the actual vial. So there, apparently the incidence of this, and I have the some articles that I can send to the group to look at as well, is really skyrocketing, particularly in the ambulatory setting. So when I talk to the leaders of this group, and I know they're coming to see you, Peter, soon, I think this month, they had just suggested that it could either be in, like, the specifications or implementations related either to the medication error or the patient death or serious disability with associated with use of contaminated drugs, devices, or biologics. You know, one of those, they had several suggested areas, but I just thought it was a topic that I was not familiar with the magnitude of. In looking at it myself, I don't know that it so much requires a new SRE as it does possibly some amplification under the implementation, either under the medication error one or the contaminated drugs and devices. So that's kind of a high-level summary.
This is Peter. This one particular group that found you or you found them is one of many that have strong concerns. The one group that you have had contact with is particularly vocal, however. But safe injection practices has come to the forefront within the world of patient safety as a very big issue. Clearly within the medication safety world, there's strong concerns about it, not just for infection, but for dosing, et cetera. Globally, it's a huge problem. And so it's an issue that has some relevance. What we proposed with the TAPS in terms of try and drive some uniformity of process was that if a new topic came up during the deliberations, then we would ask that the TAP members help to complete the submission form for a new SRE, and that submission form is what was one of the materials that we distributed for you, so that at the end of the day, we would be able to say, well, yes, new topics came up, but we did process them similarly. This particular topic has come up very, very late in the game, but its relevance is high. So Greg, Sally, and us thought it would be important to bring it forward for your folks' discussion, and then we can figure out how to manage the process, again, recognizing that this set of SREs are NQF's project or product anyways. But we want to be mindful of process.
This is Chris Goschel, and I would support the opportunity to look at this a little more closely and either, if in fact it is a new SRE or perhaps as the suggestion previously made that it could become perhaps visible but incorporated into some of our existing examples. I can tell you that we have been visited here at Hopkins by the folks from, by Evelyn McKnight and others who kind of do the one and only campaign, and it probably a week doesn't go by without being contacted by people who are quote, not only concerned about this issue, but are curious as to why the healthcare safety leadership groups haven't been more visible in calling for attention to this. So I think it would behoove us to include this in a way that is most respectful of process.
Okay. Any objections to the, what Peter suggested? And I do think that maybe this may end up this go around in one of the, as in a very specific example under the contaminated drugs or devices issue or under medication safety. Either one I think would fit reasonably, the first probably better. Any other concerns about that?
Well, this is a nice process step as I see it. And from the last discussion to this current discussion, all I can think about is what happened to Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida this past 2 weeks. And that hepatitis C outbreak essentially started 4 years ago. I can't imagine what's going to happen in the media as time goes forward with the discoverability of why did it take 4 years. So the processes here are fine, but I would think that we've got to pay some attention to the fact that how quickly can health systems track down some of these problems once they occur?
That'll be a feasibility issue here.
I think so.
Okay. Any other comments on the list of news?
Now, just to follow up on that, Greg, did you want me to do anything with that, or what was the recommendation there?
So Peter, do you want to kind of restate how you'd like to handle this at this point?
Well, I think in terms of process, Catherine, if we could bother you to work through a submission form, and we'll help you with that. If Chris wants to get engaged because of her involvement as well, that would be helpful, and we can do a fairly quick completion of a submission form.
Happy to.
Distribute it to the group electronically, and then perhaps we can come back to it for a final discussion next week.
Okay. Good. I'm happy to help with that.
Thanks, Chris.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. We'll do.
Go ahead.
This is Debbie. I'm going to have to jump off, but I do want you to know, I don't know how fast you'll get to the existing pressure ulcer event, but I've got some emails outstanding yet from some additional experts in that area, and I'm sure by our next meeting I'll have more to share related to the recommended changes there.
I don't think we're going to get to that one today.
I didn't think so, but I just wanted to let you know.
Fair enough. Okay.
We can go from the end of the alphabet and go backwards.
Yeah. A couple of quick process checks. One of them is for Melinda and for Peter. Is it essential that we have the definitional discussions today, or can they wait till we run the list of the SREs?
I think it can be done after we run the list, because there will be some topic areas that come up with generate a lot of discussion that will reflect the outcome of your decisions on the two definitions.
And in terms of, we still need to reserve the last 15 minutes for public comment?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. So what I would propose, knowing that we won't have Stan for the next discussion, I would ask you, Stan, if there are any of the existing SREs, and so we will be forced, I think, to bounce around here. We will go back and go through them systematically, top to bottom. But are there any where there are comments from your TAP that you want to make sure that we're aware of, knowing that we won't be able to hear your input on all of these?
Yes, I guess there are a few.
So if you could walk us through those, and then we'll go back to the top.
Sure. So I'm going to sort of go through them one by one. So the first one is on the surgery on the wrong body part. We agreed that it should not be wrong body part, that it should be site. And we agreed with the inclusion of invasive procedures and not just, quote, surgical procedures. One of the things that we also discussed was the definition of when surgery ends. And I know we're going to have that definition a little later, or actually at the next meeting. So let me just go through the parts that we thought were important. We brought up the issue of does surgery end when the patient leaves the room? And the consensus with everybody was no, it actually ends before that. It ends as is stated essentially right now, when the incision is closed and the counts have been completed. But that also brought up the question of, well, what if you had a wrong count or a wrong X-ray, and you know, whenever you were checking things, and needed to reopen the incision before the patient left. So our TAP thought that was a good thing, that actually that would not be a retained foreign object, for instance, but that would mean that the process was working and that it had functioned correctly. So that was one comment that was made. I think there are a couple of minor comments on 2.1b, the wrong patient, and that was essentially a process problem where sometimes different lenses for the ophthalmologist to place cataracts are just lined up for like the whole morning, and that's how that happens as a wrong patient gets something. So one of the things that we wanted to talk with the steering committee about was what about the correct implant being inserted into the wrong site or the right procedure at, the, say, the wrong level of the spine. So we were thinking that some clarity with the steering committee might be very useful on that issue, and that's on 1C, wrong surgical procedure performed on a patient.
Okay. Other issues that you think we should you want to highlight before?
Sure, I'll keep on going if that's okay. So the difficulty on 1D is with retained foreign objects is they may not be recovered for years, or they most likely are going to be recovered by someone who didn't leave them. So it would be really difficult to review the kinds of system errors that led to objects being unintentionally retained. And one of the examples here was, you know, a piece of a stapler that was used, for instance, to do a lung biopsy. So that was on 1D. 1E is the immediate postoperative death of a class one patient. We thought that this really rarely occurred and that it was going to be a really difficult issue to report about, particularly since we thought that the whole issue was going to be how you're going to investigate what happened and how that what happened with that patient. Most ambulatory care centers don't have all the committees and all the resources that hospitals have in terms of sort of digging down into all the events that were there. So that was 1E. We had no comments on 2A. Let me go through and just find the ones that we had something important to. I think 2B was serious disability associated with the function of a device. We commented about a device being used as an off-label issue and how to capture that as an event. Then we're going to go to 3A, an infant discharged to the wrong person. We think that this should really be entirely preventable, and our issue, again, was with how we defined facilities and the issue of birthing centers. Was brought up again on that issue. On 3B, patients can, in terms of elopement, this is an elopement issue, in terms of the ambulatory center, patients could actually leave before being discharged. For instance, sometimes people's family arrive there and they've been up and they just sort of walk out the door. So that was a huge issue in terms of whether that's elopement or leaving against medical advice. And so that was one of the things that we would like some clarification about for the ambulatory surgery piece. We didn't have any issues, particularly with 3C about suicides. We thought that all of those would be unlikely to occur in an ambulatory setting, but certainly if any attempts were made, they should be reported. Then we're going to 4A, medication errors, and the implementation of this event would be pretty challenging in the ambulatory surgery environment, mostly, again, because some of these environments don't have CPOE or other electronic methods for tracking and challenging and giving good feedback to physicians as they do medications. So the next would be 4B.